This is Susie Larson. I want to thank you today for downloading this podcast from Live the Promise. I do hope you enjoy it. Thanks also for your continued support of Faith Radio. I want you to know you can donate anytime by clicking on the Support Faith Radio tab. Have a great afternoon, and God bless you. Good afternoon. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I'm Susie Larson, and this is Live the Promise, and we are here to help you engage in a strong and active walk of faith. Welcome to our Labor Day Monday edition of Live the Promise. I'm really excited about today's show. We're welcoming back our good friend, Chris Faber. He's written a brand new novel, Not in the Heart. I want to get right into it because we have a lot to talk about with Chris today. So let me tell you about him and we'll get him on the show. Chris Faber can be heard daily on Moody Radio's Chris Faber Live, where he talks over the back fence with listeners across the country. He's the winner of the 2011 Christie Award for Contemporary Fiction and the 2011 ECPA Christian Book Award. You can learn more about Chris and his ministry at chrisfabry.com. Chris, great to have you back with us. Thanks so much for joining us.
Susie, thanks for taking the time. It's great to talk with you again.
Absolutely. Well, you've been on the show before, so you know we like to start out talking about Scripture, and you chose a great passage, Colossians 3, 23, 24. I'm going to read it, and then I'd love to have you just speak to it. Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart, as if working for the Lord, not for human masters, since you know that you will receive an inheritance from the Lord as a reward. It is the Lord Christ you are serving. Talk to us about that passage.
I keep coming back to it every day, and it's one of those things that's, you know, that's new to me, even as I'm, you know, getting through thinking about Easter, thinking about the resurrection, and Jesus saying, come follow me, I'll make you fishers of men. You know, this was a call. This was not just a polite little invitation. Hey, if it works out in your schedule, come on over here and do this. It was a command. You had to either obey it or not. And these verses are the same way. You will either work for God in whatever you are doing today, or you won't. You know, you can, whatever God has for you to do. If you are a plumber and you're putting in pipes today, you can do that to the glory of God. If you're a writer and you work on radio station, you can do that to the glory of God. And I don't have to. The great thing about this is, it's not up to me what the outcome is. If I'm really serving Him and I'm doing it for Him, if I'm a pastor in a very, very small church, or I'm a pastor in a mega church, it really doesn't matter in the economy of God. And that's where I think we get it so wrong, and I get it so wrong. I think it's, you know, how many followers I have on this or that, and, you know, how many people go to my website, or if people read a book or not. And it really isn't about that. And every time I read this verse, whatever you do, work at it with all your heart, that's what God is interested in. Success is not the numbers. Success is obedience to Him and following Him fully. Mm-hmm. And but it's very easy to, in this, you know, brand driven world and numbers crunching world, to get lost in that. And so that's where I keep coming back to day after day.
Well, Chris, we've just had church. Boy, that is a good word. You know, I'm thinking as you're talking of the Scripture, anything done apart from faith is a sin. So when you think, as you say, no matter what we do, we can do it out of a place of striving, which is just straining, and it's apart from faith, or of serving. And when you think of, I'm giving my day, my hour as an offering to you, Lord, that offering echoes with us into eternity. That's the offering God multiplies. So it is no small point that you're making. I appreciate it so much.
Well, and the whole the John 10:10, I came to give you life and give it abundantly. I think we think of that in terms of, you know, God, give me more stuff, or give me wealth, or even give me a deep spiritual experience, or a healing, or a mountaintop thing, this or that. And I keep coming back to, I had a guest not long ago, a young guy, a musician, who said that he was listening to the pastor one day, which is always a good thing. Mm. And he said, the pastor was saying, don't worry about the width of your ministry, how you know, big and wide that thing is. You worry about the depth. Mm. You worry about how deep you're going with God. And if He wants to expand that, then absolutely, you know, that's wonderful. But just go deep with Christ. Let Him go deeply in you. And I think in that abundant life model, you know, Jesus exemplified that, but there was an awful lot of pain, and there was loneliness, and there was friction, And, you know, it didn't all, quote unquote, work out looking really, really well to the naked eye, you know, in his life. Because he was, with all these guys who didn't understand him, and you look at the crucifixion, I mean, this looks like failure in some ways.
Yeah.
But that was the greatest victory we could ever have imagined. You know, who, they didn't see it coming on that Sunday morning when the tomb was empty. They went for a dead body, and he wasn't there. Isn't that great?
It's so great. And you think about it, that he experienced thirst and fatigue.
Yeah.
And you know, I love your verse because it talks about stewardship, and we're going to talk about that toward the end of the show, even how you personally steward the gifts and the opportunities God's put before you. But there is something to be said about diligence and using every opportunity because of the times that we're in. So really appreciate that. Well, I know based on our last interview that words of affirmation is not one of your love languages. So what I'm about to tell you probably is going to bounce off of you and you're not going to listen to me anyway. But I'm going to say it. You're a great novelist, Chris. You are a great writer.
Well, thank you.
Did that go in, or did that just
bounce? Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that's my secondary, not my primary love language, but secondary. No, I love hearing that, and I love people writing and saying, "Here's what I liked about this character. This is what changed. You know, this is what it showed in my life." I was Skyping with some folks in Texas last night. You know, with them telling me about, you know, this is where the characters met me and how I saw truth, and so that really is great. And yet, at the same time, when I hear you say that, I think, but I can't live off of that.
No, you're right.
I can't live off of Susie telling me I'm a good novelist. I need to continue to, you know, follow what God wants me to do and not get my eyes on, because here's the danger. I could believe that and then just go on and never do anything about it.
Yeah.
You know, I could never work on my craft and just rest on my laurels, the things that I've written so far, and not go any deeper than that. So I can't, I love to hear it, but I can't let that guide me and say, okay, well, I can keep writing another book. Because if this really is what God has for me, everybody in my life could say, this really stinks. I hate this book. You know, I hate these characters. And I could still be doing the will of God if that's what he's called me
to
do. Yeah,
that's a good word. You know, it's so easy to shift our weight onto the opinions of man, both positive and negative, and we can't. We can take them into account, but they don't dictate.
But I accept what you said.
Thank you.
I don't minimize that, and I really appreciate that. And it is very encouraging to hear those good words.
Yeah, I as a nonfiction writer, but I'm a voracious fiction reader. It's no small thing, I know, to weave a fiction piece of fiction. So I appreciate it so much. Well, we're talking to Chris Faber today. He's got a new novel out called Not in the Heart. And here's my question. What advice would you give to a parent who's been disengaged from his or her family? What advice would you give to a parent who's been disengaged from his or her family? Go to Facebook.com/deeperlifeinchrist. Facebook.com/deeperlifeinchrist. Not in the Heart, Chris Faber. Tell us, give us a synopsis of this story.
Well, the hook is this, and when I told it to my editor, you know, her eyes kind of gleamed and glistened. I said, here's an out-of-work, pretty successful journalist who's been downsized, who has a gambling addiction, who has all of these things in his life, estranged from his family, and he has a son who needs a heart transplant. His son is going to die. And he runs across a story of a man who's a convicted murderer, 30 days to live on death row in Florida, and this man wants to tell his story. He wants this journalist to write the story. And if he does that, this man will give his heart to his son. He's a match. They've already figured all that out. Well, the journalist begins to write the story and sees some inconsistencies, and there's a possibility the man might be innocent. So if he really is innocent, and he doesn't tell this story in these last 30 days, an innocent man's going to die. But if he tells this story and the innocent man is exonerated, his son dies. So here is a fellow right in the middle of that crucible and choices being made. And by the end of the book, somebody will die. There's no question about it. There is a death sentence hanging over two people in the story, and one of them has to.
And this is not a man of God, not a man of conviction. So he's quite in the predicament, isn't he?
He is. And he has convictions, but they're all based on himself.
Right.
His wife is a believer. His son is a believer, the son with the heart, needing the heart transplant. But he's not, and his daughter isn't. And she comes into the end of the story as well. So he is working on information that he doesn't understand. And when he goes into the death row, you know, to interview the fellow, he sees on the other side of this glass a man who is about to have his life taken, but who is freer than he has ever been. Behind bars, shackled, you know, behind the plexiglass, this guy back there is freer than Truman, the main character, has ever been. And part of that is because Truman has never been able to tell the truth about himself. He's always told the truth about everybody else. Everybody that's, you know, that he's written about in the far-flung places that he's gone around the globe. He's told the truth about these stories, about political figures, about the sports people who took the steroids, you know, all of that stuff. But he's never been able to tell himself the truth. And so the book really is peeling back the onion on his own life, seeing the frustrations and the failures and how he's coped with it, and then going a little bit deeper and seeing that, you know, the spiritual truth for him.
Mm. Okay. Where in the world did you come up with this idea?
Well, you know, these things come out of everyday life, and the stories are out there. I believe that all of our lives are stories, and they are just interweaving and interconnecting your story, the story of your life and your family and what you've gone through and mine and everybody's. But I did TV news for a little bit when I was in college, and I worked for a year with a fellow. I went to school with him who went on to work for CNN. And for the last year's work for the State Department. His very first job out of our little burg was in South Carolina, and he covered an execution. And he went in and he interviewed the fellow who was on death row, and then he was one of the pool reporters, or he was the pool reporter who actually stood in the chamber and watched this happen, and it changed his life.
Mm-hmm.
He really psychologically, emotionally, he became undone by this event. And so I used that situation with my friend, and then out here in Arizona, we met a family. They have a little farm, have some chickens, and, you know, kind of a hardscrabble life. Well, their little son has a heart condition they didn't know about, and went to the doctor, took for his sister, and the doctor said, well, here, let me listen to your heart, you know, just kind of put the stethoscope to his chest, and she heard something that was really not right. And he's had several surgeries now. After that, there have been fundraisers for little Levi. And so what I did was I extrapolated from Levi's life and fast-forwarded 18 years to see that crucible and what that family could go through. And then for, you know, my reporter's life, what that would look like if he stayed addicted to himself, you know, addicted to not seeing the truth about himself, and then getting into this situation with the death row inmate.
Well, you really do think like a novelist, Chris. You know, most of my author friends are novelists. And I remember sitting in a group with a bunch of them. I think I was the only nonfiction writer there. And they were talking about their characters like they were family members. And one of them, no lie, was planning a baby shower for her character who was about to have a baby. Because it just would help her get into the mindset. I'm like, you're all so weird. I love you all, but you're so weird. But I really do, because I love story and the power of story. I'm always fascinated by how your brain is connecting these dots to pull a story together. Just out of curiosity, how did the editor respond when you pitched this story idea? I mean, I know you said her eyes gleamed and glistened, but what would she say?
She said, this is exactly what I'm looking for. You know, this is the type of story that will hook a person and bring them into the book. You know, you can write the best book in the world, and it will sit on the shelf forever, and people won't get it unless there's something that draws them to that. And one of the things that I love about this story is that I think everybody has a Truman in their life.
Mm.
Everybody has somebody that they see making all these bad decisions, and they want them to see the truth about themselves, see the truth about God, and they've been praying, but it's not happening, and they're continuing to make these bad choices. And I think God can do something in the life of that Truman, but he can also do something in the life of the Ellen. Ellen is Truman's wife, And you can see in the midst of her struggle with her husband how God is really working, and of course her son and her daughter as well, how God is working, how God is changing, how God is forming her heart to love somebody who really is in a lot of ways unlovable.
Yeah. Well, we do know from past Barna reports that there is as much addiction in the church as there is outside the church. And there's a lot of hidden suffering going on. And so you look at the different aspects of your story, the person who's married to someone who's disengaged from the family, the person who is the addict, the person who's dealing with health. I mean, there are aspects to these characters that surely everybody will identify with. But I want to ask you, you know, you really tackle these hefty topics, death penalty, gambling addiction, murder, organ donation by
organ
death
donation.
Row inmate. Not anything too light here. But I want to know, what was your prayer that your readers would take away from this book ultimately?
I think it would be, because I think most people who are addicted are probably not going to read the book, but many people who have friends who are will. And what I really wanted them to come away with is hope. Hope of real change and not just spoken about, you know, a deep down hope. It's kind of what we were talking about before, the abundant life, something that goes deeper than just the pain of the surface. And hope for a person who's reading this that there is purpose in the midst of that pain. Most people, I think, you get into this kind of situation, especially with a spouse, and you think, why do I have to suffer through this and through all of the, you know, the bad things that are happening in the family, and you just want to run away from it. And I think there's a lot of hope here. Of course, there is also room for tough love, and I think that comes into play in the story. But I really wanted the person who read it to come away with this hope, and that God really is involved in the situation, though sometimes it looks like he's a million miles away.
Yeah, I really appreciated that you didn't rush your characters through the process. Like, Truman's daughter was not an easy sell once he wanted to reengage with her. And that is really how it would be. I mean, you kind of took your time letting her be mad and throw her fits and accuse him. But then you see that she wants to love him, and you sense her heart slowly turning towards him. I appreciated that.
Yeah. Can I read just do I have time to read a section of that?
Absolutely.
I'd love to read what Abby said, because when I read this, I did this on my program, and there was a fellow who called who pulled over on the side of the road, and he said, I am that guy.
Mm.
And the funny story about that was a police officer came up and told him that he better move on.
You're that guy, too.
Yeah.
You better get moving.
So they're sitting in a restaurant, and this is Truman talking. She stared at me with those brown eyes as she pulled on her raspberry lemonade. Maybe I feel that way because you did such a lousy job of being a dad. Maybe I feel I have to run interference because you're out of control. Maybe I feel like I'm the adult and you're the kid instead of the other way around. I'm sorry you feel that way, I said. I'm sure you are, but that's the problem. Your sorrow only covers your narcissism. I thought you were a journalism major, not psychology. You're not really sorry. You're sorry I feel this way. You're sorry I'm upset. You're sorry about everything but what you've done to your family. You don't own any of your sorrow. You put it on us. Her voice was getting more animated, and people around us were noticing. I used my most calm voice, even and measured in tone. You're right. I should just be sorry. That sent her over the edge. She gripped the table with both hands and scooted forward, her knuckles white. This was a long time in coming. I'm sure you want me to say that you've been a great father and a great man, and all these awards that you brought home make you a wonderful humanitarian, but I was thinking about your life as I drove down here, and there's a common denominator. So it was a math minor. You want to know what it is? She said. I wiped all irony and sarcasm away. Please, enlighten me. You are a taker. Anything good you've done, reporting from whatever far-flung place you've been assigned, you never gave, you always took. You took the words of the earthquake victim. You took the pictures of people devastated by wars. You gave the story, but it always came with a price. And that price was never paid by you. It was somebody else who had to ante up. And it was the same with Mom and Aiden and me. You provided for us, at least until recently. But every time you came around, you always took more than you gave. Now, when I read that, that was when the fellow called up, and he said, this is my life. This is what I've done. My kids could say that to me. My wife could say that to me. I've been a taker, not a giver. And I don't think there's any man listening, or any woman listening, for that matter, who wants to live that way. But when you get wrapped up in what you're doing and who you are and, you know, everything that's on your plate and you don't look around you, it is so easy to slip into that just take mode and to feel pretty good about it because you provide.
Wow, you know, Abby's passion is so real and so spot on. I have to know, how did you know to capture that? Have you had any kind of experience in a relationship like that, or how did you capture that?
Yeah, you know, I have 9 children, and I have 5 daughters. And usually the emotion and the passion comes from the daughters. You know, the boys handle things a little differently. And I have been, I can think about when we lived in Colorado, I can close my eyes and think of the scene of my wife and 2 of the daughters and me. And my wife and the 2 daughters are like this triangle. And the 2 daughters are arguing about something, and my wife is there listening, and she is into it, and then they're the argument, and I'm the orbiting planet. You know? I'm just kind of outside of that, that being pulled in by this magnetic force. And finally, the 3 of them turn and look at me, and I want to go in the next room and close the door. I want to go in the bathroom. I want to run outside. I want to do anything I can to get away from this because I hate this kind of conflict. But I know in my heart there is something good here, and there's something deeper, and this is the abundant life. Running away from it is not going to help me move toward them. It's going to push me further away. And so as I close my eyes, I see myself tiptoeing almost into wondering if the water is too cold or too hot, and it was, and being drawn into that because I am part of the problem that they're arguing about. I am much of the problem that they're arguing about, but I'm also part of the solution, and I never knew it until I, you know, moved into that, and not just simply saying, well, yeah, I'm a bad person and I'm sorry and I've done, you know, wrong things or, you know, whatever, but really engaging and really struggling in the midst of that. That's how I came up with Abby and her passion there. But if you read the book, you also see this incredible ability to forgive and to love and to embrace that which you can't really understand.
Right.
And so that's, you know, if you don't take that first step, you don't get the reaction.
Mm. I love that. You know, I was part of the problem, but I was also part of the solution. That is true for every one of us in any kind of relationship. If we can be humble and confident enough to face that reality, we can go deeper in our relationships. But I think most people are conflict avoiders, don't you?
Oh, yeah. We like the path of least resistance.
Mm.
It's in the Christian life, too, you know. I'd rather pray X amount, read X amount of scripture, go on about my day and have God bless it, and be tucked in. And I watched this Francis Chan thing yesterday about, and he was walking on a balance beam. Have you ever seen this?
I saw a part of it. I've heard it was great.
Yeah. And he says, you know, when it gets I get a little wobbly up here and I just want to get down and hug the beam. And so he's hugging the beam and he says, this is what most people think the Christian life is. I'm hugging the beam and then we want to die in our sleep. And no, that's not the abundant life. It's struggling, it's wobbling, it's falling, it's getting back up, it's allowing God to work through our weaknesses and our strengths as well. And if we'll have the humility to, you know, ask forgiveness and to ask him to work through our faults and foibles, he's going to do that.
Mm, so good. You know, this is a paraphrase of a C.S. Lewis quote, and you probably know it verbatim, but he said, if we look at life on earth as a place and a time to make us happy, we'll be sorely disappointed. But if we look at it as a training ground, we'll be greatly encouraged. And that's kind of what you're saying. We fall down, we get up. We sin, we get forgiven, you know. Go ahead.
And the church is not this place for perfect people. I can't, you know, run into this so often with people who say, you think you have all the answers and you're going to be perfect. No, it's the hospital, you know, for the hurting people. And we're simply the beggars who found the bread who found the opportunity for healing in our lives, and we're trying to tell other people about it.
Well, your tone and your ability the last couple times I've talked with you, Chris, to be just honest about conflict and marriage, we talked about that great book, A Marriage Carol, that really is what sets the tone for people to understand that church is a hospital and we're beggars who found the breadline. But there was a wave of time in the 80s and 90s where people in the public eye, Christians, kind of put on a perfect front. They presented so well and didn't show cracks. And that did great harm to those who in reality suffer deeply. And so I'm so grateful that we're in a day now where we can really be honest and say, I need his mercies every day. That's why he sends them to me, you know?
Yeah, and it's not just a modern phenomenon. Look at the first century.
Right.
Look at Jesus. Look at the people who needed, you know, I've come not to help the healthy, but to help the sick. That's who he came for. And the dirty little secret was they were all sick and they didn't see it. The people who thought they were healthy were the sickest because they trusted in themselves and their own righteousness and following the rules, rather than the God who loved them enough to come and keep every rule and say, I'm going to give myself for you. When you get to that point, that can be the real change in your life.
Amen. Boy, real Christian life happens when we're willing to be known as someone who needed to be saved. I'm talking to Chris Fabry about his new novel, Not in the Heart. Check out the question on Facebook, facebook.com/deeperlifeinchrist. More with Chris Fabry in just a moment. Welcome back. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise, talking to our friend Chris Fabry. He's written a new novel, Not in the Heart. Okay, I'm so curious about this. Were there any family or friend connections to your characters, or do you not want to say?
There's always a family and friend connection. I'd say the biggest one probably, other than Truman being part of my personality and having this a little bit of sarcasm and the way his skewed view of life, the big one was Ellen being my wife, because she's a very long-suffering person who there's one scene in here about the way that she drives, that Ellen drives. Truman's always got to drive if they're together, and this one scene, he lets her drive, and he sees everything that she's doing that's wrong and has to bite his tongue and doesn't say anything. I could take you to the street corners, where all this kind of thing has happened, and it's been this bone of contention in our marriage at times where she feels that I have belittled her for one thing or another, when I didn't really have that in my heart, but that's the way it seemed. And you know what perception is and reality, the person who's living it. She doesn't know what's going on in my head. That's the other thing that she is constantly saying, tell me what you are thinking. I don't understand, and so she interprets it one way, and I'll say, well, that's not what well, how do I know that? She said. So, I think communication for those of us who are in the communication business sometimes is the hardest thing to do.
Well, it's the same with drywall. If you sheetrock other buildings, you have big gaping holes in your house. So, an electrician has the wires hanging out all over the place.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Truman's addiction frustrated me to no end. And yet that is the reality of addiction. And, it takes the life out of everything it touches. And I'm just wondering where you got your information on the life of an addict.
Well, this comes from learning, from people who call the program, reading, doing research online, that the numbers of people, with gambling, especially in this book, there's something like 15 to 20 million people who are known to be addicted to it. That's between 5 and 7% of the population that will admit this, and with the expanse of gambling around the country, this is only going to go up. So, but you can get lost in the numbers. I had a friend of mine who I had no idea that he was addicted to alcohol. And he came to our house and he would work, and I didn't know of his addiction and what his family had gone through until my son came home one day from school and he said, "Dad, did you hear that Bill died?" And no. And we went over his family, and this story comes out of what they had been through in the last 10 years or so. And, you know, it's one of those things that I talk about family members. In some of my other books, I've written about this and just where alcohol will take you and to the depths that it can lead you, seeing this happen in family members' lives too. So it's one of those things that if you've ever lived it, it will leak out. You know, that kind of pain will leak out in the characters that you write about.
Absolutely. Well, what advice would you have for someone who's married to an addict?
Well, you know, I'm for marriage. And when you said I do, you didn't just say I do to the spouse, you said I do to God. And that you were going to hang in there through sickness, and this certainly is a sickness, but it's also a choice that this person is making. So my advice is to love them well. Love that person as well as you possibly can before God. Now, what does that look like? Most people will define love in this culture as, you know, the tingly feeling that Gary Chapman talks about that goes away after 2 to 3 years. Love is not a tingly feeling. Love is a choice. Love is a desire in your heart to want the best for that other person. Well, if the other person is addicted, the best for them is not to continue on the road that they're on, because you know it's going to lead to destruction. But you cannot make those choices for them. They have to make those choices themselves. So my advice would be then to put in a prayerful, strategic, and step-by-step process wherein and whereby that other person realizes that the love that you are offering them is one that is not going to allow them to destroy themselves with your tacit approval, that you're not going to be complicit, that you're not going to go along with, and that you're going to do everything that you can in a loving way to try to help them get out of the ditch that they are in, whether they see it or not.
Wow.
And I think you know where I'm going with this. That person, first of all, has to get people around them, hopefully spiritually minded people, pastors and counselors and friends, who will walk this road with them step by step and be there to, you know, when you have to give the ultimatum, if you keep this up, I'm taking the kids and I'm leaving. We're not going to take this anymore. And to have a, you know, a date set and to follow through with it and to not allow this to continue to go down this road, because the best thing that could happen sometimes to a marriage is a separation.
Yeah.
If you are separating with the hope and with the idea that you will reconcile. So, you know, those tough love principles come into play here, especially with addiction, because I have never seen anybody who's truly been addicted to alcohol, gambling, pornography, whatever it is. I've never seen anyone do this and do it alone. It's only in the context of community, only in the context of other loving people coming around them and helping them, and them seeing their need of that help.
Yeah. You know, I have a friend who says, we teach people how to treat us. And I've been had lots of contact with different people in my world that are addicts. And when they're married to someone who does that whole codependent thing and they lay down and take it, thinking of love as sort of a passivity, like my life doesn't matter, that the addict loses respect for himself and for his spouse or herself and her spouse. And there is something to be said about, I love you, I'm going to stay humbly dependent on God, but this is where you end and I begin. You don't get to keep doing this to me. And so there's a way to navigate through that. And those are sometimes the greatest wake-up calls for these addicts. So that's really a great advice. Now I'm thinking of the addict listening today who hates himself, hates herself. What advice do you have for her? She's, maybe it's gambling, maybe it's, you know, something else, but she's or he's just bound up in this addiction.
Well, the shame will bring you down to the very depths. But it won't, and it'll bring you further into yourself. And that's not the best place to go. The only place that there is, where there's real, true, lasting change is in the heart of God and His love for you. He does not want you to keep going spiraling down like this. And when you fail and when you fall, you think you are the furthest from God. And I want to say to you, no, you are very close to Him. Mm. You are a prayer away from having this thing turn around. But you have to see your need of God and His, you know, His first forgiveness, but then this restoration and reconciliation. Humility, He will give you the humility, the humble attitude that will say, I got a problem and I can't do this on my own. Mm-hmm. And when you get to that point, you know, if that's where the spiral takes you, then you are in the best place, because there have been so many people, very godly people, who have been right where you are, and who've reached up a hand because they have seen that they're at the end of themselves, and who will get help. Now, I'm not saying that it's not going to be messy, and I will say it's probably going to get worse before it gets better, and it's not going to feel very good. But God is not there to make you feel good. God is not there to make your life all rosy and pink and cotton candy and fluffy and win the lottery. As a matter of fact, I hope you don't win the lottery, because you'll get more problems than you have right now. God is there to make you holy. He is there to put you in a right standing with Him. And when you have that, when you have the righteousness of Christ, you're clothed in that, and you have His perfection on you, so it doesn't matter what you have to go through in order to, you know, to be restored to a place where you can actually love the people around you that you want to. If you really want to love your spouse, if you really want to love your children, and you are estranged from them because of this thing that's bound you up in your life, Jesus stands in front of you right now, and He says, come and follow me. And it's not a nice little invitation. It's an order. It's a command. Obey me. Follow me. I'm going to take you to a place of abundant life, and it's away from that addiction that you have right now, and it's toward me. And if you want that, He'll give it to you. Mm-hmm. And there, you know, there's some work involved between here and there, not the salvation. Jesus did the salvation work. There's some work in your life that you have to face the demons, you have to face the problems that you have in order to get deliverance from them. But if you're willing to go through that, there's something on the other side. And in the midst of all of that mess and muck and mire is the abundant life that Jesus is talking about.
What a beautiful invitation. That's the gospel right there. And what I love, Chris, is how the Lord connects our holiness with our wholeness. You know, He wants to heal all of the wounds. He wants to turn over the lies and replace them with truth. And it's a beautiful thing. Well, if you just tuned in, I'm so glad you joined us. I'm talking to Chris Fabry about his new novel, Not in the Heart. It's kind of about a washed-up journalist who is a disengaged father, a gambling addict. He's got a son who needs a heart transplant. He's doing a story on a death row inmate that is a match for his son. And boy, it's a compelling story. Well, what are your thoughts, just out of curiosity, on death row inmates donating their organs?
Well, I bring the question up not to say, you know, here's a, you know, the next issue that I want to get involved in, but just that question. If a person has, their life is going to be taken from them, should they be able to donate said organ, a heart, a kidney, a liver, lungs, pancreas, whatever? Should they be able to do that and have some good come out of this bad in their lives, and you know, some sort of redemption, quote unquote? That question is asked. Then the legislature gets involved. There's a governor. There's a political. There are political machinations that go on behind the scenes because the governor is angling for the White House. So there are all these things of, you know, you stick your finger in the wind and see where it blows. And you can see in the midst of this personal tragedy and struggle, in comes the political. And then in comes the medical ethical question that this raises. And that is, if we harvest a heart from a person or some other organ in an execution, the medical community will have to be involved in an execution, and that gets involved with the Hippocratic Oath. Now, those of us who are pro-life would say, well, you know, look at what's been going on with abortion for so long. But set that aside for just a moment and think about those implications and ramifications. It's a very sticky issue. We do not want our prisons to become places where we harvest organs from people, because in the third world, sometimes this happens that a person will be thrown into jail and then they start doing that. They start harvesting the organs. We don't want that to happen. But is there a place? I've just given you all of the, you know, the sticky wickets that are in there. Is there a place for a person who says, hey, I know that I've done wrong here. I want something right to come from my life, and I would love to have something from me help somebody else who's in need. I don't think that's a bad question to ask.
No, I appreciate how you laid the landscape. I'm sure you answered questions just as people were asking them, so I really appreciate that. Well, with the remainder of the time we have left, I'm going to just switch gears a little bit, Chris, because you're really no stranger to hardship and having your life turned upside down and having to start over again. Tell us a little bit about your story and how God showed himself strong on your behalf.
Well, it was about 3.5 years ago that I got a phone call. I was in Chicago and heading back to Colorado, and my wife said the words that changed our lives forever. She said, I think we need to leave the house. We had moved from Illinois, an 1,800-square-foot house, into this 5,500-square-foot house in Colorado, up at 7,500 feet above sea level, where we got 4 feet of snow in April. You know, it was just this idyllic thing, this mansion, really, for us. And with 9 kids and a dog and a bird and a cat and more to come, we thought, you know, this was the place where we would go grow old and die. Well, we were growing old prematurely and dying prematurely because there was toxic mold growing behind the walls of two of the shower installs. There were 2 bad shower installs. And I thought I had done everything that I was supposed to do financially. You know, I had life insurance, and I had insurance on the home and cars, and I had made investments that I thought, well, you know, these are going to grow. When we found out this about the house, we had a company come in and fix it. First one install, and then about a year later, another. And they did that incorrectly, and instead of helping us, it exposed us to even more so the toxic mold that we hadn't even seen until it was uncovered in that 1 year in 2007. So we watched our kids one by one kind of fall like little soldiers and get sick and couldn't figure out what it was, because even our pets were sick. And I could go into this, you know, the horrific things that what happened to the bird who gnawed off his leg, who was over the vent from the room downstairs, but it was invisible. We couldn't even see the stuff that was in the air that was affecting us. And the doctors, who all had different diagnoses for all of the different children. My one son, who is deaf in one ear today. My other son, who mysteriously after the exposure came down with type 1 diabetes, when we don't have diabetes in our family. You know, that's the rest of his life. His pancreas is not going to work unless there's some intervention there. So we watched all this happen. We watched the neurological thing that happened. I watched my wife go from this very competent, multitasking person to a person who could not hold one thought in her head. Who would walk from room to room and forget why she was going there, which I know happens to a lot of people. But you don't know my wife. You know, she would be having coffee with someone saying, aren't you supposed to be at the school at the Mother's Day tea? Oh, I forgot all about that.
Mm.
And so all of these things, one after another, happened, hospitalizations, emergency room visits. And we finally got figured out from a toxicologist, leave the house. Treat your house like a fire. So we, with the clothes on our backs, walked out of the home, and then we changed our clothes. We got clothes at the big box store down the street, which was a very humiliating thing to walk into that store and to see the friends who were taking care of our two of our boys buying them clothes too, and a new backpack for school. It's been 3.5 years. We've gone through all the protocol. We took the cholestyramine, which is what they give the Agent Orange people who are, you know, the soldiers who are exposed to Agent Orange. We drank the clay, which is supposed to, literally drinking mud to draw this stuff out of your system. We've gotten on a different eating plan. I've lost 65 pounds. You know, all of this stuff. But if you were to ask me today, so where are you? Where are you? Are you healed? I'd say no. No, I could go down the list and tell you of the different symptoms that we still see, the different problems, my kids, you know, the chemical sensitivity. Once you uncover this in your life, it exposes a whole new level of sickness and inability. But God has been involved in the whole thing. And though we lost, you know, the insurance didn't cover the house, so we lost that. The insurance didn't cover our treatment because we went out of network, quote unquote. So all the money that I was paying as a freelance writer, author, radio guy, going to healthcare each month was basically money down the drain because they didn't, you know, really treat what was going on. They would send us to the specialist who said, well, here, just take this pill. But they wouldn't treat the actual problem. So, you know, I could be very bitter and very angry and very, you know, stomp my feet. I saw the people of God, the church, get involved and our family get involved in ways that I, you know, I still to this day marvel. We are not in debt in, you know, with the home that we had. I could tell you a long story about that whole thing. I've seen him work in my heart because he's basically told me mold was not your problem. Mold is not your problem going forward. Your health and the restoration of your health is not your greatest goal here. Your greatest goal is seeking after me. And I think that whole thing we said a little earlier about the depth, you know, it's not how healthy I am from here on out that's going to make me happy. It's not how wealthy I am or even having my kids healthy. That's not the goal anymore. The goal is, God, what do you want in my life? What are you teaching me here today? And I'd say that same thing with a person who's dealing with a spouse who's addicted. I'd say that same thing about a person who says, I've got to get my wife back, and she's gone, or I've got to get my husband back. He's left me. I would say, you know what? I hope he does come back. I hope she does come back. But the greatest goal here is not just a restoration of a marriage, as good as that is. The greatest goal here is, what is God doing in your heart today to draw you closer to him so that you can see him work in you to bring you closer to the image of his son? That's what he's working on. And I could tell you to go out and vote a certain way or to take a certain pill or to read a certain book, but there is no substitute for that mustard seed of faith that is growing inside of you today that is struggling to burst forth with life in the midst of all of the struggle that we see around us. I think that really is my central message in everything that I write now.
Yeah, you know what I'm hearing in my mind is the passage, you know, Jesus says, in this world you will have trouble, but be of good cheer, for I have overcome. And that makes us overcomers. So that enemy means to take you out. He means to derail you. But you will not be overcome because greater is he that is in you, Chris. Appreciate that story. Thank you for sharing that.
Well, it's what happened in Job's life, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, he came out and on the other side. He still lost his family. He still lost a lot of stuff. But God did something. And it wasn't just that he gave, you know, the point of the story is not he gave him back twofold. You know, he gave him back all his stuff. That's not the goal. What he had was God. You know, and when that's what you have, it doesn't matter what the circumstance is that you're in.
So good. The time is winding down here. And you know, Chris, I have a small idea of what you juggle in that I do live daily radio, write books and speak. But you do more than daily live radio. You work on something like 3 programs. You have 9, count them, 9 children, a wife, and you write books. And I'm sure you get this question, but I still want to know, how do you balance it all?
Well, most of the time, not very well. You know, I've kind of gotten it down to a rhythm of the day and a rhythm of the week. And I do my best writing early in the morning. And so when I'm working on a project, I get up as early as I can because that is running through my head. The characters are running through my head, and I try to sit down and get that out. I write as a process of purge. You know, I don't write and then edit and then write a little bit more and say, I just go at it, and I just do what I do from the beginning to the end, and I find that that is the best for me. And when I do that every day, you know, I'm getting up every day doing that, Monday through Friday, and then sometimes on Saturday mornings. And then, you know, the week starts to have this ebb and flow in it. And I have to be able to turn that off and to say, you know, I'm not going to work on this right now. Or something else will come up, and, you know, you got to do a dental appointment with the kids or whatever, orthodontia. Then you do that. But I, you know, I find that God gives the amount of time that you want to do what you need to do is there. You just simply have to make choices. So we don't watch a lot of TV. We don't, you know, I gave up NFL football last fall, which was really big for me. If you know me, I mean, our dog's named Tebow. So this was a big deal, but I saw how much time I was spending and the energy I was expending for this sporting thing. So when the NCAA tournament came around this year, I watched the final game, but I didn't watch any of the other games. And it wasn't because I was boycotting or I was upset with the, you know, that's a great sporting event. I think it's one of the best sporting events there is, you know, the purity of it, although not as pure as it used to be. But, you know, it's a great thing. But for me, in my life with these nine kids, I really can't take that kind of time. There's so many better things I can do with my time. So we are stewards of our time and our day, and sometimes you just need to turn the on-off knob off to the computer, to Facebook, to, you know, those things are not bad. They can be really good, but sometimes you have to make those tough decisions.
Yeah, it's that old adage, you know, trading the good for the best. Boy, Chris, so enjoyed this time with you today. And as we wrap up, I'm thinking of that person listening today whose loved one is far away from God. I'm wondering if you'd pray for that person.
Amen. Yes, I sure will. Father, you know the heart of this person who's listening today is breaking. The heart of this person wants that spouse or whomever to come into a relationship with you. And I pray that you would move in and give the peace that passes understanding, that you would give your spirit, not just to answer this cry of the heart of, you know, getting this person on track, this other person on track, but will you align this person's heart? Will you align my heart today to you and to what you're doing in me and what you're doing in them so that we might respond in love? And step by step, show what love really looks like in that person's life. And have the commitment then to live it out. I pray this in Christ's name for your glory. Amen.
Amen. Title of the book again is Not in the Heart. We've got several copies to give away on Facebook. Check it out, facebook.com/deeperlifeinchrist. I'm going to leave you with this passage from Psalm 119. Listen to this. Lord, you are mine. I promise to obey your words with all my heart. I want your blessings. Be merciful as you've promised. I pondered the direction of my life, and I turned to follow your laws. I'll hurry without delay to obey your commands. I'm a friend to anyone who fears you. O Lord, your unfailing love fills the earth. Teach me your decrees. You have done many good things for me, just as you promised. Well, I pray today's show blessed and encouraged you. So glad you tuned in today. Tune in tomorrow for Live the Promise. I'm welcoming back one of my favorites, Sky Jathani. He'll be here to talk about his book, With. And if you listened last time we had Sky in the show, you know tomorrow's show is not one to be missed. We had church last time. So make sure you join us tomorrow, 3 to 4 o'clock, on the Same Faith radio station. And finally, guess what? The Lord wants you to last long and finish strong, and He's the one who'll keep you strong to the end. Have a blessed day.